Truman Taylor. The program is originating once again today from Washington, D.C. Our guests, Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island, returning to the program as he has many times before, and from the state of Maine, Senator George Mitchell. And welcome to the program, Senator.
Thank you, Truman.
Both Senators Chafee and Mitchell are on two committees together here in Washington in the Senate, the committee that deals with the environment, and also on the Senate Finance Committee, which of course deals with revenue enhancement. Is that the current
term
in vogue? How the government will deal with its deficit, and that means getting more money. And that seems to be one of the issues that's heating up as the presidential campaign gets underway, with Walter Mondale saying that indeed 1985 will have to go for more taxes. And President Reagan apparently, but not definitively in the minds of many people, saying that no, we are not going to have to go for new taxes in 1985. And from the viewpoint of both of you gentlemen, what do you think?
Well, the president, as you know, has said no increase in personal income taxes. Of course, there are a host of other taxes beside the personal income tax, and then he said he'd veto it. I personally feel that even though we have a booming economy, and even though some sizable reductions in spending will be submitted by the president, whether Congress will accept them or not, I don't know, and I think that Congress won't accept them all, even if all those things happen, the deficit will be unacceptable and there'll have to be some form of increased taxes, whether that takes the route of the personal income tax, which the president said he'd veto, or some other route, I don't know. But all I know is if we're going to get these deficits under control, we've got to have more revenue.
What's the Democratic perspective on 85 and taxes?
There will definitely be a tax increase next year, no matter who is elected president. The federal budget deficit for the most recent fiscal year was $195 billion. We're spending money we don't have. It can only be reduced through a combination of spending cuts, restraint in domestic spending, spending on defense, and increased revenues, and that can only come through a tax increase. There's no doubt in my mind that no matter who is elected president, there will be a tax increase next year.
A personal income tax increase?
That depends upon who is elected. Mr. Mondale has said if he is elected, he will propose a variety of taxes, including a personal income tax. The president has said that he is opposed to a personal income tax. As you know, there have been tax increases in the past 2 years. They have not been income tax increases, those have been cut. I think you're likely to see a increase in some other tax if the president is elected, perhaps a national sales tax, increased excise taxes. It all comes out of the taxpayers' pockets in the long run.
Is a national sales tax, or value-added tax, as it's called, is that palatable to you?
I think it would be very dangerous politically to put in a national sales tax. I also am not sure that that's the right, I personally would not favor that. I think that what we ought to do is take a look at these various proposals, which we're already doing in the Finance Committee. One of the approaches, of course, is to start from scratch, eliminate all the deductions, exemptions, credits, and have what you might call a flat tax. Let's not get into the discussion too much of what a flat tax is, but basically it means no exemptions or credits. You take your income, you may get a few deductions such as for home mortgage interest or charitable giving, possibly local property taxes. Beyond that, nothing.
So the $100,000 a year executive would be getting the same tax as the $20,000 a year worker?
Well, no, I think the term flat tax all too often means a single tax of 20% or whatever it is. But I think what they really mean, and what I support if we went into something like that, would be no exemptions, credits, or very few, but a graduated tax. In other words, you just like we currently have. So the fellow who's making $50,000 a year pays more than twice as much tax as the fellow who's making $25,000.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and several other major business groups are apparently very quietly cooking up an alternative budget, as they're calling it, a plan to reduce federal spending rather than to come up with an increased tax. This is the same group, as I understand it, that promoted the tax cuts back in 1981. One of the main thrusts, apparently, is to secure a five-year phase down, as they're calling it, of growth in the government entitlement programs. Specifically, for instance, they're talking about trimming the cost of living adjustments for Social Security recipients, as well as military and civil service recipients. Is this something that is possible to do in order to perhaps avoid a tax?
That will have to be done to deal with the deficit, but it cannot serve as a substitute for an increase in revenue. The fact is that if you eliminated all government, the entire federal government, except for defense, Social Security, and interest on the deficit, you would still have a deficit. There isn't enough revenue. You could eliminate the FBI, the Justice Department, the Coast Guard, everything else the government does, and you'd still have a deficit. So there has to be restraint in spending, and entitlements is a major part of the problem with which we must deal in a reasonable manner, taking them all into account. But that cannot possibly serve as a substitute for an increase in taxes. There has to be a balanced approach which involves all three elements: restraint in domestic spending, principally entitlements; restraint in defense spending. The president's budget, in my judgment, is unwise and unnecessary, extravagant in the extreme in terms of the defense budget; and thirdly, some increase in revenues. That is the only way that a program will realistically address the deficit and have any chance of enactment by the Congress.
What about the many of these entitlements are hinged on the cost of living index? What about chipping away a little bit at that, maybe bringing it back to 60% as far as increases are concerned, 60% of the CPI?
Well, I think it's politically unrealistic to expect that that will be done. The president, for example, himself suggested that we remove the floor on the increases for the cost of living. As you recall, there is a provision currently in the law that says if the cost of living is goes up less than 3%, then there'll be no cost of living adjustment granted. The president himself said we ought to eliminate that and give everybody the cost of living, even if it's a half a percent, and that whipped through the Senate before you could say Jack Robinson. So I think to expect the changes in Social Security are unrealistic, and frankly, I think it presents a lot of problems for the people on old age pensions. So even though you try to come at it with a balanced approach, as Senator Mitchell suggested, namely attacking defense and all the other domestic spending programs and the other entitlements, there are a host of other entitlements, agricultural, food stamps, whatever it might be, dealing with Social Security is a separate subject, I think.
What about raising the qualification age for Medicare from 65 to 67, perhaps, gradually, not all at once, in the same way as raising the age for Social Security?
The Medicare program, that portion which is funded from the Social Security tax and which is part of the Social Security system, that's Part A of Medicare, is now experiencing financial difficulty and, under current projections, will be insolvent in about 1989. It's clear then that between now and 1989 we must deal with the Medicare funding problem in a broad way to ensure the solvency of the system. That was one of the elements in the Social Security reform package, and it undoubtedly will be proposed and could be a major part of the Medicare revisions as well. There are a number of others that ought to be taken into account. Essentially, you can only do two things when you have a budget that's not in balance. You can increase the amount of money coming in, or you can decrease the amount of money going out. What you have suggested is the latter. That is, if you reduce the age within which persons are eligible, on the average, you therefore reduce the amount of benefits being paid out. It's going to have to be a combination of that and increasing the revenues coming in Medicare, just as we dealt with Social Security last year.
Truman, let me just say one thing on the Medicare. I completely agree that the Medicare is in deep trouble and something has to be done. I don't think anybody's suggesting changing the age from 65 upward because, as you know, people can receive their Social Security starting at 62 and full amount at 65, but in the United States, it has turned out that the overwhelming mass of the people choose to take their Social Security before the age of 65. So if they leave the workforce, that is, they leave the company they're working for at 64 or even at 65, then they lose their health coverage that is normally supplied by the corporation. Well, to have a two-year gap there between 65 and 67 with no medical coverage would be unacceptable. So we've got to look at the Social Security, the Medicare, in a host of ways, but that isn't one of the suggestions that I've heard anybody make, that is extending the age.
I had heard or read a published report that it was one of the suggestions being put forth by this group that I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Business Roundtable, the National Federation of Independent Businessmen, the American Business Conference, the National Association of Wholesale Distributors, the same group that put together the 81 tax cut lobbying effort, which was very successful. So it would seem, or am I wrong, that we can't really discount the suggestions that this group is putting forth?
Well, but the point I tried to make is that I don't think you can deal with Medicare in the same way that you could not deal with Social Security by taking individual suggestions and saying yes or no to that. You must view the entire program in context. You have to establish what the amount of the shortfall will be based upon the best current economic projections, and then try to meet them in a balanced way that doesn't ask any one group to absorb all the sacrifice and represents both increases in revenues and reductions. I'm aware of that proposal by the Chamber of Commerce Net Group. I happen to think that some of the suggestions are unrealistic. As I suggested earlier, it's impossible to close the budget deficit simply by cutting spending, and therefore it's something that'll have to be considered, but you have to consider both the source and the nature of the proposal. I think it requires a much broader analysis than just saying one thing, raising it 65 to 67.
One of the things that the Treasury Department now has recently decided to do, and there's been a good deal of criticism of this decision in order to help finance the deficit. The Treasury Department is going to be selling unregistered Treasury bonds to foreign nationals who are expected to flock to this trough. And those who criticize this new method of financing the deficit say that by so doing, we run the danger of making the United States a debtor nation. Is this a real?
Well, we're a debtor nation anyway. Some $80 billion has flowed into the United States to buy our securities, whether they buy them directly or whether they buy euro dollars through the Netherlands Antilles. The proposal, that's kind of a complicated thing, but what we did was we said that instead of going through the Netherlands Antilles, now the United States corporations or the United States government could sell its bonds directly abroad, something that wasn't happened, without a tax that previously had been levied. That's to open up to the Europeans easier access to the money, to invest money in the United States. That was the suggestion. That will help money come in here, but the further point that you made was, should this be without registration? In other words, somebody could buy a bearer bond with no inability to trace who the interest was being paid to. And that, I think, is a bad idea, and the Treasury hasn't done it yet. They're thinking about it, but I've written them and said, I don't think you ought to do that. That's bad. That'll encourage what we call non-compliance, people not paying their income taxes. I mean, in other words, Americans could buy them and then escape paying their taxes in the U.S., which is bad business.
We are relying increasingly, and in my judgment, to a dangerous degree, on foreign capital to finance our deficit. And I don't think that this is the problem. The problem are high interest rates in this country. That's what attracts foreign capital to this country, the fact that interest rates in this country are higher than anywhere else, and to a lesser degree, our political stability, which is, of course, something we value. But that goes right back to the budget deficit. We must reduce the deficit in order to keep interest rates from rising and, indeed, to bring them down. And until we do that, we're not going to stem the flow of foreign capital. If I could just complete my thought on Medicare, because there's one point I think that must be made. By far, the largest component of the problem we have in financing Medicare is the runaway increase in the cost of medical care. Prices for medical care, hospital costs, doctors' costs, and others, are rising much more rapidly than the general rate of inflation. As we all know, the general rate of inflation is way down, but the price of hospital and other medical care continues to skyrocket. And we must take steps to try to contain that. We've taken some steps this year. The diagnostic related group and prospective method of reimbursement for Medicare is a first step by the Congress in an effort to rein in that increase. That is a very important factor in dealing with the problem of Medicare. It's not just going to be reduction of benefits.
Let me just touch one more government spending issue before I want to get into the hazardous waste and the environment in general for the final few minutes of the program. What about military spending in the coming year? Can you put a percentage on it after inflation, what the increase should be, just a number?
Well, the current increase is somewhere in the neighborhood of 7%. I just think it could be lower than that. You can always find ways to spend more money in the military. It's an insatiable appetite that exists there. But I'm confident that the nation's security could be protected absent the very substantial increases that they're having. And that's where the big dollars are. I mean, I'm talking big dollars, over $200 billion.
Would 3% after inflation, a 3% increase after inflation in the next increase be realistic?
I think in the neighborhood, yeah, something like that. I think that's a little low, but I think it could be way. I was thinking in the terms of around 5%, but certainly below the 7+ that's being talked about now.
I favor an increase of 3 to 4%, which is about a third of what the president proposed in terms of an increase, and about half of what is currently being projected in the Senate budget figures.
What's going to happen with the MX missile? A lot of arm twisting apparently is going on in the Senate now to get by the president to get his way. What's going to happen there?
I don't believe it will ever be fully deployed, nor do I believe it should be. I think it is the most colossal waste of the taxpayers' money in modern American history. In my judgment, not only does it not enhance our security, but it actively diminishes our security, dramatically accelerates the arms race with no corresponding benefit to us. I think the merit of it is becoming increasingly in doubt as the margin of support for it shrinks almost every time it comes up for a vote, and therefore I think that we will not proceed with it ultimately, and I think if that does occur, that is our not proceeding, it will be a good thing for the United States and enhance the security of the people of this country.
Are you in agreement with that, Senator?
No, I'm not. I don't agree with that. It seems to me that when you are negotiating with somebody at the table and they walk away, that the response on our part shouldn't be, well, that's too bad, therefore we'll reduce what efforts we're making to modernize our missile force. There's no question but what the Minuteman, which the MX is replacing to a gradual degree, is antiquated. It's going to become obsolete soon. And the Minuteman is a step in the modernization of that force. The numbers have been reduced, and if you cancel the Minuteman completely, you'd make a saving of something like $9 billion. Now, that's hardly going to balance the deficit of the United States, which is over $160 billion, $170 billion. So I think we should proceed as every president has proposed in the last 10 years. With this modernization of our force, and I think failure to do so is a dangerous step to take.
And you feel that the MX will be deployed?
Oh, sure.
In the final analysis?
Sure. I mean, maybe, hopefully, we can get to some kind of an agreement at Geneva. But in order to agree, reach some kind of agreement, you've got to have the other side present. They've chosen to walk out. They chose the reason, as you know, they left because of the intermediate arms talks, but then they said, well, while we're leaving on that, we'll also leave on the long-range missile talks as well, and have just failed to come back. We've done everything we could to entice them back to the table, but they haven't. It seems to me now say, well, you've walked away, so therefore we'll cancel one of our missiles. While they're proceeding with several new types of developments is a mistake.
Go ahead.
If I may just comment,
sure.
It is obvious that we have not proposed the MX missile in response to the Soviets walking out. The MX missile was proposed long before the current negotiations even began. let alone terminate it. So there's no relationship in that regard. And secondly, as to the budget deficit, I think that's the problem. Certainly, $9 billion won't balance the budget by itself. But there is no single act that will balance the budget by itself. And the only way we're going to balance it is to save $9 billion here and $2 billion there and $200 million here and $400 million there. If we look for a single action of government that will balance a $195 billion budget deficit, then it's never going to happen. This is the place to start, in my judgment.
Well, let me just have a little rebuttal on that, Truman, if I might. I wasn't suggesting that that the MX missile came up after they walked out. The MX missile has been on. We've been proceeding with the MX missile for some time, but then they walk out. We'll say, since you've left, we'll cancel what we are going ahead with. Doesn't make sense, but in my judgment. Secondly, those people who are against the MX missile all too often vote for spending program after spending program on the floor of the Senate, and you ask them how you're going to pay for it. Oh, we're going to pay for it by canceling the MX missile. And they've spent that MX missile cancellation 15 times over. It's true there's got to be a host of savings, 9, 10, whatever it is, 2 there, but it's got to, you won't find it all in the MX missile by a long shot. It's got to come in other programs as well. Well, we've explored that. Let's get on with it.
We rebut that, or?
No, I think I do want to say that there are not many things on which my good friend John Chafee and I disagree, but that's one of
that's
them. I just don't think the argument about dealing with the Soviets, that's the argument that's been used at every step of the arms race, that we must build this in order to be able to negotiate. The result in every single case, save one, the ABM system, was to increase and accelerate the arms race. And we are now moving perilously toward a nuclear holocaust in this world. Relations between the United States and the Soviet Union are at an all-time low. We possess between us 50,000 nuclear weapons, even though all scientists agree it would take but a few hundred to completely destroy both countries. And the notion that we enhance our security by building more and more missiles and pointing them at the Russians is a proven fallacy. They're doing the same thing. And so the result is the level of the balance of terror rises, the world slips closer to a nuclear holocaust, and both sides say, we've just got to build up. I think it must end in an arms control agreement and in steps that enhance our security, not diminish it. And I think what we're doing now is diminishing it.
Well, so. The rebuttal against the rebuttal, let me just say this briefly. I think we all agree that what we've got to do is get to the arms talks. And the arms talks in the past have resulted in a slowdown of the race rather than a decrease. Hopefully, two things have got to happen. One, the Soviets hopefully will come back. That's what we're all hoping for. I don't think we're encouraging them to come back by unilaterally disarming or reducing our modernization. Secondly, that when we get there, I hope that it can result not only in a reduction in the increase, but a decrease in the total forces.
Well, I want you to get to hazardous waste, because that's where I agree with John Chafee.
That was my next question. As you know, more money for cleaning up hazardous waste sites is hung up in the Senate. The dispute being how much money to get industry to pay. The House wants big fees, the Senate won't accept them. What's this? Is this another case of big business getting its way in the Congress, or what?
Well, first let me say on this subject that I've had the pleasure of serving as the ranking Democrat on the Senate Environmental Pollution Subcommittee, which Senator Chafee chairs, and I think no member of Congress, and indeed perhaps no citizen in this country, has done more to advance the cause of protecting our environment and our public health and the quality of life for Americans than has John Chafee. He's done an outstanding job in shepherding major legislation through, and we're now working on the Superfund. There is a balance to be struck here, as in most areas of public policy. We want to protect public health and the environment. That means someone must pay for it. The industry that creates the materials that become hazardous waste must bear the responsibility, but we cannot simply willy-nilly raise taxes without any regard for the impact on them, because there are hundreds of thousands of American jobs at stake there. And so what you have to do ultimately is achieve some relative balance. I think we will get a bill ultimately out of the Senate. It will probably be less than the House, but it will be enough to do the job that must be done to clean up the waste that scar our countryside.
See, Truman, one of the problems is, as Senator Mitchell has so aptly said, is that this tax currently is on the chemical companies alone. And therefore, when we increase this tax, the House hasn't passed a bill yet, but they will very soon, is my understanding. When they increase the tax substantially over what it is now, and by that I mean four or five times, it has the danger of making those companies non-competitive with the foreign imports, or if they try and sell abroad, making them less competitive than they are now. And that is a real danger, because going back to what Senator Mitchell said, there are hundreds and thousands of Americans working in the chemical industry, and particularly the pharmaceutical industry. And if we make these companies non-competitive so that their foreigners can come in and flood the market and make it so that our companies cannot sell their goods because of these heavy taxes, we really have hurt a lot and will result in not getting the revenue that we need for this Superfund.
But if industry doesn't pay for it, who will? I mean, isn't the great American tradition, you made the mess, you clean it up?
They will pay for it. The question is only one of degree. The tax will be increased. The base will be broadened. More substances will be taxed than are currently the case. The only question is, what will the appropriate level be? What needs to be done? I think we will arrive at an acceptable level that will do what has to be done to protect the public health. It will probably be less than what the House has proposed. Nonetheless, it will be a sufficient amount, in my judgment.
In the final couple of minutes that we have now, let me just ask, in regard to this new EPA report that was just released stating that far more American homes and office buildings and public buildings, schools, factories, far more than had previously been imagined, have serious problems with asbestos. And although we've been talking about the serious life-threatening consequences of asbestos fibers in the air for a number of years, not much seems to have been done. For instance, this EPA report is apparently the first definitive report as to how extensive the problem is.
Well, I think it's a little unfair to say that nothing's been done. We've been working on our schools, so that's the principal
that's
way, and obviously this will for awaken us to proceed faster and on other public buildings as well. It's a terrible problem, as you point out.
We have about 30 seconds, if you'd like to just make one comment on that subject.
One of the unfortunate byproducts of an industrialized society is chemical contamination of the air, land, and water. The first step in the asbestos problem is a thorough assessment of the problem, a determination of the cost, and then a decision who's going to pay it. It will undoubtedly, inevitably be federal, state, and local cost sharing to deal with the problem.
Senator Mitchell, thank you very much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Senator
Chafee, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
I'm Truman Taylor. Have a good night tonight and a better day tomorrow.